Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Today we're going to talk health. Fitness, well-being, all those important things. It's a great week to be doing it. Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Glad to have you along here in Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls, Chris Rogers at the phones. And Ted, I discovered this just looking at an article today that more than 8 million Americans have some blood sugar issues in their bodies, don't know it, or put it another way, about 1 in 8 people with so-called prediabetes, often a precursor to full-blown diabetes, only 1 in 8 know they have a problem.
Wow, it's that's like, startling.
Yeah. Man. Lack of awareness. People with elevated blood sugar levels are also less likely to make lifestyle changes, such as getting more exercise and eating less sugary foods might prevent them from ultimately becoming diabetic. We're going to talk about it today as we launch Thanksgiving week, have a conversation about health and wellness with Lisa Marone. And we've got some extended time with Lisa. And normally she joins us every other Monday for a few minutes at the end of the show, but we've got an opportunity to have her on here for an extended portion today. So I want to say we're going to take your calls. If you have some questions about health and fitness and therapy and all those kinds of things, we'd love to have you join in at 877-93-FAITH.
I saw a bunch of healthy athletes yesterday get a win at the U.S. Bank Stadium.
Sure. Oh yes, you were one of those. Instead of the 22 people down the field, you were one of the thousands up in the stands.
That's right. Yeah,
desperately in need of exercise. Right.
That's so. About right. Yes.
Well, you know, a lot of things in the news today. We can talk about Obamacare or pipeline protesters in North Dakota or trains running off the tracks in India. I thought, you know, one of the most encouraging sights I saw was right outside my office window. There's a semi-trailer getting filled with boxes, shoe boxes, for Operation Christmas Child. And our studios are a collection site, and we've seen this Ministry of Samaritan's Purse grow over the years. So if you put together a shoe box, thanks. I mean, it's just an amazing outreach.
Such an easy thing to do, too, yeah. And especially, again, teachable moment for kids. We've talked about that before. Go out, buy a few things, and put the box together and make a world of difference for a person.
It's not high-tech by any means, but it has eternal impact. Well, I just wanted to say thanks if you were part of the Operation Christmas Child. But Faith Radio is going to be partnering with Prison Fellowship starting here after Thanksgiving for Angel Tree, which is something that we are passionate about as well. 1 in 28 American school-age children have a parent in prison, so there's a great need. So be looking for information on that on our website about Angel Tree. And I want to say a special thanks to those listening online across the country. It's a growing number of listeners that are tuning in or logging on to or streaming the programming. So welcome to you, especially are listening to Faith Radio. And, of course, you can always download the app. So if you're heading over the river and through the woods to Grandma's house, you can take us with you.
That's right. Anywhere you go.
If you are heading off to Grandma's house, there's probably going to be some interesting conversations this year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, politics and just with the world, the state of the world, I guess, in general.
Well, John Stone Street says, you know, maybe you just want to get together with friends. No, actually, he's saying that's a new trend. John Stone Street is up next.
Sauce tastes better with friends. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. Here's a new term for you, friendsgiving. Dreading the clash with family members over politics and religion, some Americans are planning to invite friends over for Thanksgiving instead of joining relatives. Google Trends logged a huge spike for that word, friendsgiving, after the election. Many are dreading coming home to parents, grandparents, and opinionated uncles and aunts with whom they deeply disagree. And so, friends, the people you choose to be around, just seem like more fun. Of course, there's nothing wrong with celebrating with friends, but we shouldn't avoid family. Why? Because, well, we didn't choose them. And disagreeing is no excuse for not engaging with them, even if the tough topic surfaces around the table. What an opportunity to learn and demonstrate real love, not just mutual liking. And of course, open your celebration to those who can't join their families this year. Invite them to join your family celebration. After all, there's always plenty of turkey to go around, isn't there? And maybe they'll take your side against that crazy uncle. I'm John Stone Street.
All right, great to have you along today on Connecting Faith, and I always appreciate the opportunity to connect with Lisa Marone, who's a physical therapist, a professor, author, and a speaker who engages people to get healthy, for heaven's sake. That's one of her great books. She's also authored other works as well, Sleep Well Again, Overcoming Back and Neck Pain, Diabetes, Are You at Risk? And that's one of the books we want to and topics we want to focus on right away during our conversation. I do want to just mention, though, that our phone lines are open at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. If you have a question or comment, want to join in the conversation. Many of us are overweight, slouch, deconditioned, and very tired. That's kind of what some of the topics that Lisa addresses in her book, Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake, Seven Steps to Living Strong, Loving God, and Serving Others. And that's one of the reasons why we want to talk health. And certainly as we head into this week, it's an important time to be thinking about how we're taking care of the bodies that God has given us and that we're being good stewards of that. But Lisa, we want to focus today on diabetes and why it's such a significant disease. So welcome back. First of all, good to have you on.
Great to have you guys on. Happy almost Thanksgiving,
yes,
to Ted and to you, Neil.
We're looking forward to a good week ahead, and we'll get into talking diet a bit and what we eat in a moment. But let's start out with the topic of diabetes. It's a huge issue. Maybe we need to define what it is.
Absolutely. You know, the reason it's such a huge issue, there was a study done that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association this past August. And stunningly, they found that one out of every two adults over 20 years old had either pre-diabetes or diabetes. That's 50% of us over 20. So that's incredible. Now, what is that, pre-diabetes and diabetes? In a nutshell, it's our body's losing the ability to manage our blood sugar levels. So when we eat and our food becomes sugar, we need to be able to manage that, store it and spend it in a way where our blood sugar levels stay in a healthy range so that the rest of our body can function the way that God has designed it to.
How can it be that, and I know that, as I mentioned just kind of at the outset, that a number of the people that, you know, are in that pre-diabetes category don't have any understanding of it. Maybe many of us have things going on in our body that we're not aware of, but it seems like wouldn't we kind of have an idea and know?
Well, first of all, for the people who have pre-diabetes, what pre-diabetes is somewhere between healthy blood sugar regulation and extremely harmful blood sugar regulation, which is diabetes. Now, pre-diabetes, people look at it as like, well, I'm kind of still safe because I don't have a diagnosis of diabetes. But in that pre-diabetic state, while you don't know or necessarily feel anything different happening in your body, science has found that even having slightly elevated blood sugar levels are creating mini silent heart attacks, mini silent strokes in our body. We're starting to get this inflammation in our cardiovascular system and in our joints. And so we are already beginning to build the other diseases that diabetes is responsible for in that pre-diabetic state. So, Neil, if you don't feel any different, that's not unusual. So the reason a lot of people don't know they have this situation is they're neglecting to go to their annual doctor's visit and have their blood work done and have this taken a look at.
If, by the way, if we get that blood work done, that will show up right away, right?
Now, it will. Now, let me just clarify. There's two different blood tests that are used to look at blood sugar regulation. The first is the one that's most typical. It's called a fasting glucose test, which means you show up for your blood work not having eaten for 10 or 12 hours, and they take a one-time measurement of what's your blood sugar like. And it should be, for normal people and healthy blood sugar metabolism, it should be 99 milligrams per deciliter of blood or lower. So 99 is your top number. Now, if you have pre-diabetes as per the Journal of American Medical Association test, what they tested their subjects with is an even more sensitive test. It's called an A1C test, Neil. I believe we spoke about this probably months back, but an A1C test is really indicative, better, a better indicator because it looks at not just that one day when you're fasting, but it looks at the last 3 months, day in and day out, after your meals, in between your nighttime, how much control has your body had over its blood sugar? And what begins to happen, and you can find this out maybe 8 years before your fasting glucose test comes back positive, your A1C test will come back positive. And so that's why this study in the Journal of American Medical Association showed higher levels of prediabetes than any study had before, because they were actually testing what happens after you eat a meal. Can your body get that blood sugar back down in time?
We'll talk more about how to do that, how our body adjusts to the blood sugar in the moments ahead. But I want to ask, Lisa, this is particularly problematic for low and middle income individuals and poorer countries too. Why is that?
Well, it often has to do with, first of all, the quality of food that's available to us. Less expensive foods are usually higher in sugar. They're very processed, so we're eating white breads and white pastas and white rice. And those things spike our blood sugar very high, starts to create a situation where our bodies become exhausted, continuously pulling down that blood sugar, and our pancreases, which is the organ that helps us to regulate our blood sugar, they begin to malfunction. So that's one of the reasons, Neil. But another reason is that there's just oftentimes in poorer income situations, there's less access to health care, and there's less understanding of the disease processes that happen in our bodies. And so if you combine those, it's kind of like the trifecta, the perfect storm of why you might find more diabetes and prediabetes in that population.
One of the other, I guess, disconcerting things is that this the number of people with this is expected to double in the next 20 years. That seems a little alarming.
It is frightening. When I wrote my book, Diabetes, Are You at Risk? That was published in 2010. And in there, the latest studies show that 1 in 3 adults at present have prediabetes or diabetes. So that's 2010. Now in 2016, we're now finding 1 in 2 have prediabetes or diabetes. So this is something that's escalating probably at a rate that may even be greater than doubling it in 20 years.
Not a good direction to head. We're going to talk about how to counteract it and more in the moments ahead with Lisa Marone. Lisa's physical therapist, a professor, an author, and a speaker, encourages people to get healthy, for heaven's sake. We're referencing her book from a few years back called Diabetes, Are You at Risk? And, in fact, we're learning that most of us probably are. So how can we minimize that risk? What does that look like? How do we stay healthy in this area? And it's certainly a good topic as we head into Thanksgiving week to be thinking about how we process and take care of food, and just we'll get into other aspects of living well, fitness and the like, and maybe just some even recommendations for some good meal habits here as we come into holidays. All that's ahead here on Connecting Faith. You're welcome to join us if you have a question related to health, fitness, and diabetes. Certainly love to talk with you. Lisa Marone's my guest. You can call us at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Or you can submit a question or comment online if you go to myfaithradio.com. There's a Connecting Faith show page with a little email tab there. You can just click on that and submit your question. We'll talk more in a moment.
Giving.
Nineteen past the hour. I'm thankful for our health, especially if it has gone through some challenges recently, then you know how precious that is. Talking today about being healthy, for heaven's sake. And Lisa Marone is our guest today, physical therapist, professor, author, and speaker. She's a regular guest here on with us on Connecting Faith. We have for some extended time today. We want to talk about just the area of how we care for our bodies, particularly as it relates to diabetes, which is something that's affecting a growing number of people. And wondering, Lisa, is this something that we can immunize against? Isn't that, we're always looking for the pill or the shot solution. What are the options here?
Yeah, I would love it if there would be an immunization against it, but unfortunately it's not. It's really a lifestyle disease. A long time ago, it used to be called adult onset diabetes, this type 2 diabetes. But now we're onsetting it in childhood. And so we've now changed the activity levels that we used to maintain, the type of food that we're eating, the quantity of food that we're eating, and we have created a disease of choice, if you would, Neil. And the sad thing is that a lot of times people think of it as just this this one diagnosis, diabetes. But diabetes is the beginning of a whole host of other issues that we really need to be worried about. You know, two-thirds of people who are diabetic end up dying of a heart attack or a stroke. So there is such a heavy connection between all of the other parts of our bodies that we need to make sure that, listen, we can't immunize against it. The best we can do is we can offer people medicine. And so, Neil, oftentimes my patients will say, well, my sugar's a little high, but my doctor said if it gets too bad, he's going to put me on medicine. And they kind of just think, okay, good, that's fabulous, I'm done. I'm medicine, it's cured, but that is not correct. Most people who have prediabetes do end up with diabetes, about 80-some-odd percent. And when you are on diabetic medication, it will slow that transition from prediabetes to diabetes. You know, it will slow it down about 3 years. It'll hold it off. But if you were to change your diet and you were to increase the amount that you actively move, you will set that prediabetes conversion to diabetes, you will set that back 11 years. So while the magic bullet seems to be medication, it's no magic bullet at all. It's just a temporary extender.
So we can't necessarily reverse it, but we can certainly slow it down and regulate it better.
Well, you know, the exciting news, Neil, is you can actually reverse prediabetes and early onset full-blown diabetes. So if you're kind of newly diagnosed, you're not a many year old diabetic, you can actually make changes. And I've done this with my patients. I've given them dietary advice and exercise advice, and they've made these changes, and they have gotten off their metformin medication, and their blood 6 months later, 12 months later, is beautiful. They're back in the normal range. So this is not something that once you're diagnosed, oh, too bad, it's too late. This is some great news.
So let's talk a little bit about what are the ways that we can readjust our lifestyle, because this is a lifestyle disease. So you talked about eating and exercise. What are maybe some of the first things that we need to do? And obviously, this is something that we need to be concerned about for our kids as well, right? We know that childhood obesity is a growing problem as it is for adults.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Neil, to understand that, I think people need to be educated as to how their bodies function in terms of metabolizing sugar, and then it will all make sense. So I'm going to start there.
Okay.
When you eat something and your stomach digests it, it turns into glucose molecules. Those are sugar molecules. And your body's pancreas sees the amount of sugar that has been created by digestion, and it will send out an adequate amount of a hormone called insulin. And that insulin will take that glucose molecule and it will change its molecular shape so it's ready for storage. And then, as if it was a key, it will open up the storage containers in your fat cells, in your muscle cells, and in your liver cells. And it will then store that extra sugar molecules away for a later use. Now, that's what happens in normal. Now, if you eat sugars that or foods that increase your sugar level like very quickly, such as a glass of orange juice, or you have a bagel, something that is either very close to sugar when it starts, like orange sugar, fructose, any kind of juice, apple juice, orange juice, or something that changes into sugar quickly, the body sees the blood sugar rising so fast, and it becomes frightened, and the pancreas dumps out excessive amounts of insulin because it doesn't know where that spike's going to stop. But it knows if it can't stop it, the body will die. And so it throws a ton of insulin out. Now, we do this day in and day out, meal in and meal out, and that excessive insulin production does two things. One, it tires your pancreas out of making it. But the other thing is we get this insulin resistance, Neil. And insulin resistance is there, while there's so much insulin in the blood, the body ignores it after a while. It's kind of like a mom with a toddler who calls your name all day long, mommy, 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 and the mom can just shut that off after a while, doesn't hear it. And so our bodies shut off the response to insulin. And what we end up is with too much sugar circulating in our bloodstream and a whole lot of havoc that comes from that.
And does most of the food that we take in, does it turn to sugar eventually? Does it, I mean, you mentioned like a bagel and, you know, orange juice. You think, well, normally that, I guess orange juice we could see probably higher in sugar, but bagel would seem like, well, that's carbs, isn't it?
That's carbs. And if it's simple carbs where there's no bran involved, so that's white rice, white pastas, white bread, while you're chewing it in your mouth, the enzymes in your saliva are already changing it into sugar molecules. So by the time it hits your stomach, it's well on its way to being sugar. And because there's no bran involved to slow your digestion down, it spikes your blood sugar similar to having a glass of orange juice. And so that's really an important thing for people to understand. So your original question, Neil, was like, well, how do we eat to prevent this? And there's a few things that we can do. And one of them is going to be that we don't load ourselves up with things that spike our blood sugar. And so while it has been marketed to us that a glass of orange juice with our breakfast in the morning is fabulous because it's loaded with vitamin C, it's actually not fabulous. And so God created fruit to be eaten as a whole. You know, there weren't juice bars in the Garden of Eden here. So there was fruit. And so when we eat fruit with its fiber, it doesn't spike our blood sugar. But when we squeeze it into a glass, apple juice and orange juice, that's where we start with those blood sugar spikes. So we need to make sure that we pair our food with things that will digest slowly. And so those things are protein, they're healthy fats, and they're carbohydrates that have lots of their bran in them. So there's a slow burn within our stomach of food to sugar, as opposed to a very quick, rapid burn, like putting paper on a fire.
Just thinking about, you know, we want to pair food with kind of a slow burn. You know, there's a whole slow food movement, but that's not the same, right? That's, I mean, this eating slower is not going to make a difference, is it? Or will that, in fact, make a difference?
Correct. Those are two different things.
Okay.
Eating the speed at which you eat is not going to necessarily make a difference. Now, the volume in what you eat is also going to be influential here. So if you eat too many calories at a particular meal, you rush out in the morning, you don't get to have breakfast, you have a cup of coffee, you grab a little piece of this, but you go to lunch and you eat a tremendous amount of calories. Well, your body doesn't need all of that right then and there. And so it's, again, spiking your blood sugar really high, dumping insulin into your body, and our bodies are becoming insulin resistant. And one of the first signs, Neil, that we're insulin resistant as adults is we start to put on some weight in our midsection. And many people call it, oh, it's the midlife spread, and that's just what happens. It's happening in midlife because we've been eating improperly through our 20s and 30s and 40s.
We'll talk more about how we can get back to eating right and talk fitness as well and how we can get healthy, for heaven's sake. That is our focus today with Lisa Marone, physical therapist, professor, author, and speaker. She's a regular contributor here on Connecting Faith, and we have her for another 15 minutes or so. If you have a question or comment, you can join us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH, and we'll talk more with Lisa Marone in just a moment. Today to Connecting Faith. I'm thankful to have connected with Lisa Marone, who is a physical therapist, a professor, a speaker, an author. She's written books like Overcoming Overeating. It's Not What You Eat, It's What Eats You. But written about overcoming headaches and migraines, overcoming back and neck pain, diabetes, are you at risk? Sleep well. And also written Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake, 7 Steps to Living Strong, Loving God, and Serving Others. And one of the ways that we can live strong and love God and serve others is that we take good care of ourselves. And we've been talking particularly about the concern of the growing issue of diabetes, and so many with the pre-onset diabetes, so that we've got some issues with regulating our blood sugar. And Lisa, you kind of touched on it earlier, but this there's a connection between what heart attacks and cancer too. I mean, we all are fearing cancer, but there's more to it, isn't it?
Yeah, most people feel like, okay, diabetes is a disease in and of itself. But what is part of diabetes, that prerequisite to diabetes, is this insulin resistance. And what insulin resistance has been found to be is the precursor for inflammatory diseases. And so there are cancers such as breast cancer, endometrial cancer, colon cancer, which begin to develop because our bodies are insulin resistant, and it sets up the inflammatory environment for that. Our heart disease, we used to concentrate so much on how much, what was our cholesterol level like, and we're still kind of living there. You know, we're taking statins to bring our cholesterol level down. But here's the thing, if our blood vessels were not in the state of inflammation, and they become inflamed because of insulin resistance, if they were not inflamed, then that circulating bits of cholesterol, when they hit into the side of the walls of our vessels, they wouldn't irritate them so much and create all of this plaquing. It's because our vessel walls are not in a healthy state. And so we really would do ourselves well on so many fronts if we would just improve the way that we ate and how much we moved.
We'll talk moving in a moment, but let's say more about, you know, the way that we eat, because you mentioned about pairing foods. So what would that look like maybe for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, maybe even a Thanksgiving meal?
Yeah, you know, this was a revelation to me. You know, when my kids were little and I didn't know any of this information, I would give them apple juice in their sippy cups, and I would give them some Ritz crackers if they needed a little snack. And all I did was give them a huge spike in their blood sugar. And what I have since learned is that when you pair a protein with a fat or a protein with a carbohydrate, that we end up having a very a great reduction in the blood sugar spikes. And so I would have been much better off on that Ritz cracker that is really just a circle of sugar, if you would, if I were to spread some almond butter on that. Because when that was taken down into the stomach, the healthy fat in the almonds would have reduced that blood sugar spike. And I should have never given my kids juice in their sippy cups. They should have just been trained to drink water. I did that when I knew what to do, and now that's what my kids do. But so that's important. The other thing, Neil, is a lot of times people feel like, well, I'm having fruit. I'm bringing fruit to work as my snack. You know, I went strawberry picking this weekend. I brought 10 strawberries in. Well, that's wonderful because strawberries have some really great vitamins in them. But if you eat them by themselves without, say, a small piece of cheese or a handful of nuts or something to that effect, you're going to spike your blood sugar as if you had a glass of orange juice again. And so it's really important that we pair and partner those things. We'll be out at restaurants likely during the holiday seasons. And, you know, if you absolutely need to eat a piece of bread out of that bread basket, you are better off, Neil, to dip that bread in olive oil or even smear some butter on it, because that fat will reduce the blood sugar spike of that piece of bread in your belly. Kind of counterintuitive.
It is, yes, and I'm looking forward to a big slab of butter on my next piece of bread. No, probably not. One of our listeners wanted to know how about natural versus refined sugars? Is that does that really matter? Because does the body know any difference?
Doesn't. Yeah, that's a great question. It actually doesn't matter at all. So regardless of the type of the sugar, raw honey, organic sugars, they are all glucose molecules. Chemically, under a microscope, they all look the same, and our body responds to them the same. So sugar that comes from fruit, which is fructose, or sugar from table sugar, sucrose, what have you, from beer, they're all the same kind of sugar.
Right.
And so our body will absolutely respond with a spike given those.
Patty from Cologne says, she said, I read something about drinking a lot of milk can help prevent diabetes. Is there any truth to that?
That's interesting. I did not read that article, but here's what I would say about that. Recent studies have shown that our push towards low-fat milk and low-fat cheeses and such actually isn't as helpful as we thought. And they found that people who ate whole-fat cheeses, were actually slimmer, and likely because they were more satisfied with less. And so anytime you put something in your belly, say milk, it could even be coffee with milk. If it's filling a hole in you in terms of reducing your hunger, then likely you're eating less. And so, but I'm not a big proponent on a whole lot of milk. There's a lot of research out that, you know, we are the only animals that drink milk after we've been weaned. So that should start to tell us something that maybe that's not actually the best thing for us. But that study I've not come across yet, so I can't answer directly to that.
That's fine, I think, but just a good word. You did mention about eating less, and, of course, we are at the season where eating less is a particular challenge. Just any tips on how we can do that and just actually, you know, have a little bit more moderation and what kind of difference that will make for us?
Absolutely. Here's what I do, Neil. First of all, I try not to drink my calories. I would rather eat my calories. And so rather than having a hot apple cider and then some soda and then a glass of wine, all those sugar-laden things, when you come to the holiday, a holiday feast, you might say to yourself, I'm going to have one glass of something calorie-laden. Don't have multiple glasses throughout the day. Drink water the rest of the time. So that's one point. The other thing is sometimes people will skip breakfast because they say, I'm going to eat so much at lunch today, I'm just going to save myself the calories and not eat breakfast. But the problem is the way that our metabolism works is we have to keep our metabolic fire stoked with a little bit of logs here and there throughout the day. And so if you don't eat breakfast in the morning, when you eat, you will overeat more than you would have eaten if you came into the meal not starving. And you will also then have a metabolism that can burn off your lunch quicker. So that's another point that's important.
Talking about how we how food and fitness can impact how we keep good health, get healthy for heaven's sake is our focus today. We've been talking a lot about diabetes. So one of the areas that we can reduce risk is through fitness. And just say more about that here. Just some general things that would make a difference if we're pairing our food a little better. What kind of exercise things should we be doing?
Well, here's a great thing, Neil, is that they don't know why exercise helps to reverse diabetes and prediabetes, but they do know it has something to do with the insulin receptors that are on our muscles. So remember I said earlier that our glucose is stored in part in our muscle cells. And so somehow the physical act of using our muscles in exercise improves our blood sugar metabolism. So that's just a great thing. The recommended amount of exercise is still at about 150 minutes of moving throughout the week. It can be clustered in a weekend or it can be spread throughout the week. That doesn't seem to matter, as the studies have shown. But if you are exercising, you want to do something so that your heart rate is elevated and your respiratory rate, your breathing, is heavy enough that you would have a difficulty having a normal conversation with someone. You would sound a little bit of out of breath, kind of like that, if you were talking to them. So that would be a moderate form of exercise. It would be a little bit breathy if you were talking.
And again, we're not saying it has to be this or that, right? It really is about the doing that activity over some sort of extended period of time, so we're elevating heart and breathing.
Correct. It doesn't have to be what we think of traditional exercise. You can go rake your leaves. You can vacuum your house. You can go up and down your stairs at home. You can turn on some praise music and have yourself a dance party. It doesn't actually matter as long as your body is moving and your lungs are pumping.
We often know that sometimes maybe if we are already overweight, then it seems like injury can happen pretty easily. I mean, we stress knee or ankle joint, some of those things. Say a word about just finding balance there, but still do something.
You know, I ask my patients who come to me with the typical problems of someone who's overweight. They might have plantar fasciitis. They may have knee pain. The first thing I tell them is that if they reduce their body weight by about 10%, they're going to improve their symptoms markedly because our bodies weren't built to carry excess weight. And so certainly if you are overweight and you want to begin to exercise, your best bet is not to go into some heavy-duty pounding kind of exercise until you start to drop some of your weight. So walking, swimming, bicycling, things that don't put an excessive amount of stress on your leg and the joints of your leg or even your low back area. But Neil, that the idea of our body weight is really neglected. It's amazing. I read a study the other day that 74% of men are overweight to obese. And that's just astounding. And two out of three adults, women and men grouped together, are overweight or obese. And so we're heading into not only physical problems, but just chemical problems within our bodies. And when you look at your belly and it is bulging, that is a little disease factor right there. There are toxins and all sorts of poisons that fat produces. And so when we are looking, Neil, to get our bodies ready and active for service, to be fit for our King, to do what he calls us to do, we really need to come to this Thanksgiving season and say, I'm thankful for the health that I have. I'm thankful maybe now for this new knowledge that I have. And even though this is a time of celebration, it's just as important to celebrate the gift of health and life that we have by eating with respect for our bodies during this holiday season. And that in that we can share our gratitude and our, even just demonstrate our worship to the Lord.
Is there a recipe or two, or maybe a side dish, something that we could change out that might make for a more healthy holiday?
That's a great question. A lot of times during the holiday season, we try to make things extra, extra special. And so, say, for instance, you know, everybody's table, we have sweet potatoes. But sweet potatoes apparently are not sweet enough for our palates. And so we will take nuts and we will put them in a pan with butter and sugar and we'll caramelize them. And then we will throw those on top and then we will put marshmallows and we'll bake that. We don't need to do that to ourselves. So sweet potatoes are awesome. God created them awesome. Why don't you mash up sweet potatoes and serve them just beautiful and orange and great for our bodies. So that's something. And even just the side dishes. We don't need to do a green bean casserole that has fatty, fat-laden soup in there and those fried onion things. We don't need that. So if we took green beans, fresh green beans, and we just sauteed them in a little bit of like garlic, and do add some butter. Butter is not bad for you in portion, you know, in a small amount, and it is a holiday. Make your vegetables very flavorful. Let's not put them gook and other things on top of them that are just making them bad for us.
That's a good word. Say, we're just about out of time, but someone wanted to know about drinking calories. Is almond milk, is that a option that we could consider?
I'm not quite sure how they get milk out of almonds, Neil.
Okay.
I have not seen those milked before.
No.
So I'm just thinking about that factory with all those almonds
being
milked. You know, I think that there's really – almonds are great for you, but – almond milk doesn't have any of the fiber. It has very little of the good fats in it. And so if you can't drink milk and you need to put milk on something like cereal or what have you, then there's an option. But it's really not worth the expense. Grab yourself a handful of almonds. And if you're looking for the nutrition in almonds or have, you know, a low-fat milk of some sort with your cereal. But there's a lot of hype in certain products, and I think that's one of them.
Lisa, what's the website? People want to just find out more about your writing and your speaking. What would you recommend?
My website is my name, lisamorone.com, M-O-R-R-O-N-E. They can also find their way there by
www.restoringyourtemple.com. Restoringyourtemple.com. That's an appropriate way to wrap up our time together. Lisa, I always enjoy the opportunity to dig down a little bit deeper, and thank you for your encouragement for us to get healthy, for heaven's sake.
Thank you, Neil. I so appreciate being able to share.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, and thank you for being a part of Connecting Faith today. Lisa Morone, physical therapist, professor, author, and speaker, encouraging us to get healthy for heaven's sake. You can find out more on our website, lisamorone.com. Coming up in a moment, We're going to talk a little bit about gratitude. There's a new study about gratitude that can encourage us along the way.
Life is short, I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short, I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for. Awaken on my soul. Every breath that you take is a miracle. Life is short.
Thanksgiving week, and we're celebrating God's goodness to us. RestoringYourTemple.com is one of the websites you could find out more from Lisa Marone about some ways to get healthy, for heaven's sake. We're going to talk a little about gratitude for a moment. Looked in the archives here this week and found an interview Don Rupp had done with Dr. Robert Emmons, a professor at the University of California, Davis, and a researcher on a new study that looked at how practicing gratitude can make you happier. It's called Thanks. Let's give a listen.
There is now a science of gratitude. You know, scientists are relative latecomers to the topic of gratitude or gratefulness or thankfulness. And for centuries, philosophers and theologians have led the way in discussing and talking about what gratitude is. But lately, psychologists have jumped on and tried to understand what it really means for a person. How do you study it? How do you create more gratitude? And why would you even bother to do that? What are the effects of gratitude in people's lives? So scientists are applying the tools of science, observation, experimentation, to try to understand this age-old virtue.
What is gratitude?
Well, gratitude, there's a lot of ways to define it. I think the simplest is to really think about it in terms of an appreciation for things we normally take for granted. So benefits, gifts, favors, things that we have, maybe they're material possessions, maybe they're just kindnesses we receive from others, maybe it's just a pleasure we feel by being out in nature. It's a sense of thankfulness for these various benefits and realizing that not all of those are totally of our own effort, that we realize and recognize the contributions that others have made to these benefits in our lives. It turns out that gratitude as a practice of cultivating gratefulness, of counting blessings, of appreciation of what one has is one of the strongest predictors of happiness. And happiness matters because happy people are more successful in life. They're more productive. They're more satisfied with their relationships. They're better liked. They contribute more to society. So anything that gets us to create a sustainable long-term increase in our happiness is going to be very powerful, and gratitude is, in fact, a reliable route to happiness.
Is gratitude a choice that each individual must make or decides not to make?
You know, that's a great question. I really think that it is. The more that I study it and look at it and examine it and talk to people and look at the science of gratitude, it really is this conscious decision. It's an attitude. And we can choose our attitudes. That doesn't mean it's an easy choice. It doesn't mean you can just press a button one day or one morning and become grateful. But by really, you know, making this decision a commitment to practicing gratitude, one can at least start a process of developing a deeper sense of gratefulness. And it can be as easy as, you know, learning to say thank you on a regular basis, keeping a gratitude journal, and that's a choice. But it has to be an intentional choice. Because I don't think it comes easily or naturally to many people. It really has to be practiced. Much like physical exercise, this is a mental exercise that has to be, you know, practiced and performed on a regular basis.
Well, tell me about your research.
Yeah, so when we began our research, you know, I was asked to attend this conference on positive psychology. Positive psychology is really a focus on strengths or virtues, again, qualities that for centuries philosophers and moralists and theologians have written about, things like hope and joy and optimism, forgiveness, humility, and gratitude was one of them. And I was assigned the topic of gratitude, told to, you know, go out there and find out what do we know about it? Is there any science of gratitude? And this was about 10 years ago, and there really wasn't 10 years ago. So I had to do some research right away. I thought, well, what's the fastest and most, I think, persuasive way of making a case for why gratitude is important? So we did research where we had people keep gratitude journals on a regular basis. Go home tonight, write down five things in your life for which you're grateful or thankful. Then we had a second group of people, just the opposite, what we called the hassles condition. So these whiners and complainers, we asked them to go home and write a list of things that went wrong today, five complaints. And then we compared these groups. We had about 100 people in each group. At the end of 3 weeks of doing this every night for 3 weeks, we looked to see if there was differences in terms of the psychological health, physical health, relationship satisfaction between these three groups. So we did this very simple experiment, and we did find that there was some really measurable and noticeable differences between these groups.
What were some of those differences?
Well, the main differences had to do with both psychological health. So the people who were keeping gratitude journals felt more energetic, more alive, more determined, more vital. They felt just more engaged in their lives. So it seemed to really augment what we call high-energy positive emotions. So they just felt more engaged with the world. They also felt better about their physical health, so they're less bothered by health complaints. They slept better. They exercised more. They were more refreshed when they woke up. And then lastly, in terms of relationships, they felt closer, more connected to others. People who knew them, people who were living with them, spouses, roommates, noticed the changes in these people, noticed that these people were happier and more energetic and a little bit easier to live with overall, I would imagine. So there seemed to be a number of benefits, physical, psychological, relational, that accrued from the simple practice of keeping a gratitude journal.
Well, for the Christian, the Bible is just full of challenges and encouragements to be thankful.
It really is. I believe the word thanks in its various forms, thanksgiving, thankfulness, appears about 150 times when one looks at the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. And the phrase, the imperative to give thanks, which is saturated throughout the Psalms and Paul's letters in the New Testament, occurs about 30 times. And I think that's instructive. The fact that it's repeated so many times implies that we need to be reminded of this, that it doesn't come easily or naturally, but it's something that we can become very forgetful of and therefore need to be reminded of it on a regular basis.
Well, our worship includes praise, and you also say that our prayers should include gratitude as well.
Well, worship I really think of as praise and thanksgiving, the twin pillars of worship. Now, I'm not a worship leader, not a theologian, but certainly you look at the scriptures, you just see it, that praising God for who God is goes hand in hand with thankfulness for what God has done for humanity. And so there's really this close link, this natural connection between praise and thanksgiving as elements of worship. And you look at worship music from traditional hymns to contemporary worship music, and you just see the language of thankfulness and gratefulness is just permeated throughout.
Well, we've heard the verse many times, and we've quoted it, "In everything give thanks." It sounds so easy. But like you say, when times are hard, when we're climbing the mountain and we can't see the end, gratitude is still important.
It's essential, I believe, to really living life the way in which life was intended to be lived.
That's some good words from Don Rupp and his guest, Dr. Robert Emmons, professor at the University of California, Davis, one of the leading scholars in a research project out a few years ago called Thanks, How the New Science of Gratitude Can Make You Happier. And we want to say thank you for tuning in to Faith Radio today and listening whenever you can. Again, you can download the Faith Radio Network app and enjoy it. Take it with you when you're heading off traveling perhaps this week, and wish you safe travels. I want to remind you, tomorrow we're going to talk about the family table. In fact, Ted and Amy Cunningham say it's time to slow down and enjoy a meal together as a family. And discover deeper faith in the process.
You might have some advice on how to handle conflict, I would think, too.
Yeah.
A lot of people are worried about that this holiday.
And they, in fact, got some great questions, things you can ask. You can sort of direct the conversation maybe before it gets in an area you don't necessarily want to deal with. So we're going to talk tomorrow. Come to the family table, slowing down to enjoy food, each other, and Jesus with Ted Cunningham. Ted's a gifted pastor and got a lot of fun as well. So I know you're going to enjoy that. Beware tomorrow for Connecting Faith. We'll talk at the family table. Very timely conversation just ahead.